perspective and analysis of the latest news out of Washington. The headlines keep coming, fast and furious. It's hard to keep up on the news out of the White House and Congress, and even harder to put it into historical context. What do the actions so far of the Trump presidency and the current Congress mean for the future of our country? Senate leadership appears to be favoring the so-called nuclear option in order to get Neil Gorsuch confirmed to the Supreme Court. Will that change the nature of the Senate? What will the Senate Intelligence Committee find in its investigation into alleged Russian meddling in the presidential election? And where will those results lead? What are the ethical implications of President Trump giving his daughter and son-in-law such important roles in the White House? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll ask these questions and more of three Maine political science professors. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A potential nuclear option, a filibuster, investigations into interference by a foreign power into a U.S. presidential election, failure to keep a campaign promise to overturn Obamacare. These are just a few of the headlines emanating out of Washington recently. What are the implications for our country? In the studio with me to try and make sense of all of it with some analysis, Ron Schmidt. He's a professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Jamie McCown, a political science professor at the College of the Atlantic. And joining us from Bates College, Stephen Engel, chair of the politics department there at Bates. As always, we want to hear from you. What are you thinking about as you read, watch, or listen to the news out of Washington? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. As often happens when we plan a show about happenings out of Washington, there is breaking news right before we went on the air, and that is that Steve Bannon is now not on the National Security Council. Ron might not even know this. He just came from class. Steve Engel, what do we make of this? What does this mean?
I think it's a little early to figure out exactly what it means, but I think in part it suggests that General McMaster has gotten a little bit more control over the NSC and that we're seeing a shift towards a more traditional NSC structure with the inclusion of the Joint Chiefs, the Energy Secretary, the representative to the UN. So I think we're seeing a kind of shift towards a more traditional approach to foreign policy, possibly.
And Jamie, but wasn't the whole point of the Trump administration that we're not going to do things the way other people did it?
Well, at first, we're not going to do them the way that they did it. And then we're going to maybe do them the way that they did it a little bit differently. I think the administration's spin that they're putting out this morning, today so far, has been that this was always part of the plan, that Bannon was in on the NSC just temporarily to undo some things that had been done before, deoperationalize, I think was the word that he's being quoted as using, and that in fact now that McMaster is there, it was time for him to go. I think, you know, Steve's account of this is probably more likely that what's really going on is that you're seeing some shifting power centers within the administration and that McMaster is consolidating his influence over the NSC as a result. So that's, you know, we don't really know for certain. We may never know entirely for a while, at least. But that seems like the most likely explanation.
And Ron, shifting power centers are not something that just happens in this administration.
No, they're not. And it's hard to get a new presidential administration moving. The early weeks of the Clinton administration were contentious and difficult. It does seem that Donald Trump's management style tends towards almost encouraging battles among varying power centers. So at this point, it looks like General McMaster is consolidating some control, but I wouldn't be surprised to see more shifts in the near future.
Okay, more breaking news is that Senator Jeff Merkley's filibuster, old-fashioned filibuster, ended at 10:30 this morning. This is all tied up into the Neil Gorsuch nomination, the potential that the Senate may invoke the nuclear option. I'm going to start with you, Jamie. Explain the nuclear option to those of us who don't follow this very carefully and why it's so significant.
Okay. So I'll try to do this a little briefly. Votes for approving a Supreme Court nomination are actually majority votes. So as a result, you only need to have 51 votes to actually approve the Supreme Court nominee. However, to actually close debate on the matter, what we call a cloture vote, you have to have a higher number of votes for that. You have to be able to stop discussion and move to the actual vote itself. And that's actually a higher number. That's a three-fifths vote, which is 60 total votes. That number is actually was higher earlier in the early part of the 20th century. It was two-thirds. It was changed in 1975, I believe, to be a three-fifths vote. So basically, even though you only have to have 51 votes to approve a nominee, you actually have to have 60 votes to close off debate on it in order to move to that vote. And as a result, a filibuster in the more modern sense of it is when basically if a minority party that can't stop the actual approval vote because they don't have the 51 votes uses that higher threshold of 60 votes in order to stop, you know, you actually going to a vote in the first place. The nuclear option would basically be an option where if the Republicans, and it looks like this is what's going to happen, know that they're not going to have enough votes, the 60 votes for cloture, they will actually change the rules, which only requires a majority vote, and lower that threshold so that closing of debate now would only require 51 votes. That's called the nuclear option because it basically sets the precedent that from now on it will only require 51 votes to stop debate on something and move forward on a vote specifically for Supreme Court nominees. This is actually was changed in 2013 for lower court nominees already.
Ron,
hope that explained it a
little.
Yeah,
no, excellent. And Ron, if Senator McConnell does invoke the nuclear option, does it change the nature of the Senate? Is this sort of a watershed moment for the Senate?
Well, you could argue that the watershed moment came a few years ago. The shift to not having a filibuster on lower court nominees a few years back was a big change. They only made an exception for Supreme Court cases, but the implication even at the time was that a filibuster that was attempted in a Supreme Court case might bring about the firing of the trigger on that. So, I mean, this is significant. There are still legislative filibusters, but still the filibuster is an old Senate tradition. It basically is a way to register the intensity of preference of big minorities. And getting rid of it is important, but it's been more or less dead on the floor, I think, for a few years now.
And Steve Engel, I want you to weigh in on this. Is the entire purpose of the Senate going to shift now as a deliberative body that's different than right. the House?
Well, I do think that, as has been said, we've been trending in this direction for a while now. So we know that the judicial filibuster for Supreme Court justices is sort of already always on the table since the change in 2013. I do think it sets a possible precedent for the end of the legislative filibuster. I think that could be potentially difficult to deal with in the sense that you clearly have some Republicans who, like Senator McCain, who is very much supportive of preserving the rules. And so I think it would be harder to change the legislative filibuster and get rid of that. If that were to happen, then the Senate, I think, would operationally be much more similar to the House, which did away with its own filibuster at the end of the 19th century, I believe.
Okay, so where do we go next? How about Donald Trump hiring his daughter and his son-in-law, Ron Schmidt, and giving them really important jobs, especially Jared Kushner, his son-in-law? Now, we know that Bobby Kennedy served as John F. Kennedy's attorney general, so this is not completely without precedent. But what does it mean?
It suggests, I mean, you're right. Bobby Kennedy did come into the West Wing with his brother, and John Quincy Adams had one of his sons working as his personal secretary. But because President Trump has suggested that he can separate himself from his family business interests because his children run the business, the more that he brings family members into the work that he does in the White House, the more questions it raises about potential conflicts of interest. Jared Kushner is not one of the sons who is in charge of the Trump business empire at this point, but nonetheless, it continues to raise questions about Trump's failure, I think, to distance himself from the conflicts of interest of his financial holdings.
Stephen Engel, I just saw Ivanka Trump being interviewed this morning on the television news, and she said that she's put her own company's assets into, she's disconnected herself from them. But then the interviewer said, but your siblings are and your family members are controlling your company. Did you think of selling it all together? And she said, well, I can't because the name of the company is Ivanka Trump. I don't want other people, creating a brand in my name. It's complicated, isn't it?
It's certainly complicated to the extent that the brand is the name. And so full separation is a challenge there. But what I would also add is even in the case of, say, Robert Kennedy had a specific position, and it was sort of clear what was in the portfolio of that position. With someone like Jared or Ivanka, their roles are, I would say, underspecified and quite large. The portfolio of Jared Kushner includes everything from solving problems in the Middle East to reinventing government efficiency. So he has a tremendous amount of work, which could suggest a tremendous amount of power.
Jamie McCown, let me ask you this. If there are people out there who are really, really, really concerned about the possible ethical implications of having the president and his family making decisions that would possibly be in their own financial interest above the interests of the country at large. But it seems to me that there's a great portion of the population that doesn't seem to care.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in terms of if we're just looking at the political calculus for this, and it's not as much that it's going to get you a lot of traction among what we might consider swing voters or undecided voters or people that are going to make a big difference in terms of Trump's long-term political future. I think that there were people who probably just assumed that this was going to be an issue when they voted for him, and they liked that he was a business person and that he was successful. I do think Steve's comment, though, is actually very well taken about the fact that these positions in particular are not well defined and that they're kind of these very amorphous advisory roles. And, you know, you've seen already, you know, some people who have very strong concerns about this conflict of interest are using the courts, hoping to try to use the courts to try to, you know, file suits against the administration. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know whether or not these will be successful. But politically, I think this issue is going to be one where if you don't like Trump, you think this is a huge problem. If you do like Trump, you probably don't think it's a huge problem.
Mm. Stephen, I want to read you a quote. There's an article on Politico about Kristen Gillibrand. And the last sentence of the quote, I think, is the article is really interesting. They're quoting Senator Susan Collins, who's talking about Senator Gillibrand. And Senator Collins says, "She has enormous ability. She works extremely hard. She's engaging. She's young. And don't take that as an endorsement or I'll be in even more trouble than I am now." Stephen Engel, is Susan Collins in trouble?
Well, I would say that she occupies a unique position as a somewhat centrist Republican. And so we've always understood her as a swing vote within the Senate, someone who could work across the aisle. I think that potentially in terms of local politics, she's put herself in a bit of trouble insofar as to the extent that she sided with the Trump administration on some particularly controversial questions. And so people have asked whether or not she is as independent as she has often suggested.
Jamie, what's your view from Bar Harbor on where Susan Collins stands and her influence?
I mean, I think we've got a long way to go yet to be able to tell. I mean, there are going to be a number of issues that are coming up that is going to really define whether or not someone like Susan Collins, and particularly the handful of moderate Republicans in the Senate. I mean, we just got through with the health care issue where, you know, the Senate didn't have to really get involved necessarily because it stalled out in the House. But we have a variety of other matters coming up, including a big spending budget debate coming up at the end of this month. There are going to be a number of flashpoints where I think she's going to be in a very interesting position to see whether or not, you know, how she aligns herself, not just in terms of her own base here, the Republican base, but absolutely among moderates throughout Maine who may not necessarily be happy with her aligning herself with the Trump administration.
Ron, is she thinking about re-election or is she just thinking about being able to be effective in Washington?
Well, those two things aren't really opposed. If people think you're a lame duck, if people think that you have a chance of not coming back, they have less reason to try to work on longstanding legislation with you or to take potentially uncomfortable stances with you. So even if you're thinking about, say, running for governor relatively soon, you don't want that to be your profile in Washington. You want to be perceived as someone who's there to help other people, to craft legislation.
Okay, let's talk about our other U.S. Senator, Jamie. Senator Angus King yesterday announced that he would oppose Neil Gorsuch. I think it was yesterday. The days all blur together now. After a long deliberative process, and it was a very long press release outlining his reasons. Were you surprised by his decision? And what do you think the political implications of that are?
I'm not entirely surprised by it. I mean, keep in mind that technically as an independent, he still needs to be able to maintain the kind of left side base of the core Democratic Party to support him. And so there's a lot of heat and a lot of passion there on that side for people who want to make sure that their elected representatives, be they senators or House members, but in this case the Senate, are, I guess, fighting against Trump's agenda. And the Gorsuch nomination proves that. I think one of the things that was really interesting about that release is that he didn't just defend his position on the basis of Gorsuch's policy or basically his stance on a number of different court issues. He also talked about the process, saying that Gorsuch had not been forthcoming during the hearings and during the deliberations. So that he was saying it wasn't just that he was opposed to some of the jurisprudence that he might have, but also to the way that this had been handled, the way that this particular person had done his interviews with the committee. And I thought that was a very telling sign for what kind of how he will be spinning this down the road.
Ron, were you surprised by the decision?
I was not. And I thought he handled it fairly well. Mainers at least say that they have an appreciation for politicians who are independent or who are moderate. And in this case, I think what that means is that if you're going to vote largely with the Democratic minority in the Senate, you need to make it clear that you're doing that for specific reasons that go beyond party identification. And that's what generally I think the senator tries to do, is to clarify he's taking this stance with the Democrats because of reasons 1 through 20. And I think he did that in that case.
Steve Engel, if Governor LePage challenges Senator King for Senate, does this vote make a difference?
That I'm not quite sure about. What I would say is that with Jamie and Ron, I'm not surprised by his ultimate decision. I do think that there was some strategy here in saying that it wasn't because of substantive claims or ideological positioning, but it was a process argument, that there's something about the process of vetting the nominee that went wrong. And I do think that that nicely positions him as a kind of centrist moderate who would appeal to the main voter.
Well, we're talking with three main political science professors about national news out of Washington. What are your questions for them? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Alec Baldwin talks about his new memoir, and, of course, we'll talk about creating his Donald Trump impression for Saturday Night Live.
You know, the people that I work with, they're just really, really the most fantastic people. They're fantastic.
Alec Baldwin on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Tune into Fresh Air coming up tonight at 7 o'clock. Do you value and appreciate public broadcasting? Lend your voice in support of this valued service. Participate in our I Love Maine Public testimonial campaign. It's designed to raise awareness of what Maine Public means to Maine and its citizens. You can be a big part of this initiative. All it takes is a minute of your time. We have an I Love Maine Public hotline, photo opportunities, and a written and verbal testimonial vault. There are any number of fun ways for you to join in. Please go to mainepublic.org to see all the ways you can participate. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, your chance to weigh in on the news coming out of Washington. In the studio with me, Ron Schmidt, a professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Joining us from the Bangor studio, Jamie McCown, political science professor at the College of Atlantic. And joining us from Bates College, Stephen Engel, chair of the politics department at Bates. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We are going to go to listener calls and emails. And I'm also hoping to get to a couple more topics that we weren't able to get to yet, which include Russia, healthcare, and taxes. But we'll start with this email from Andy on Jeff Sessions. Andy asks, on Jeff Sessions, has he reappeared before Congress to address his lying in his testimony regarding the contact with Russia? Are there no consequences for this? Who's been thinking about Jeff Sessions and his role here?
Well, he has recused himself, correct, from certain dealings with the Russia investigation. I don't believe the Senate investigation has asked for him to appear, and I'm not quite sure where the House investigation stands at this point.
Okay, since he brought up the Russia investigations, my question is, and Ron, I'll give you this one. Is there any precedent for this? If the Senate Intelligence Committee concludes that Russia did meddle and affect the outcome of the presidential election, then what?
Well, if they determine that Russia did do that, then I think there are several courses that they would have to take. They'd have to first of all, issue a complaint with the Russian government itself. I assume that they would want to order the executive branch of the government to take steps to penalize Russia for its intervention. I imagine senators from both parties will also try to provide a particular narrative for the findings of that of their evidence, but the evidence would have to be presented.
Hmm. We have Facebook post from Elaine. Bobby Kennedy's position, if I'm correct, required Senate approval, a key difference between his position and the current administration's nepotistic appointment, Steve.
Yeah, I think that's right. Bobby Kennedy was, if I recall, attorney general. And so as a cabinet level position, that would require Senate confirmation. Here, I think so that level of amorphousness that we were talking about before the break, his position is underspecified. The portfolio is quite large. It is a little bit concerning that the claim of nepotism with regard to the Kennedys and the Trumps, I think, is substantively distinct.
All right. We're going to start with the callers and John in Whitefield. Hi, John. Go ahead.
You're on Maine Calling. I'm very concerned about this nuclear option business. If the Senate goes so far to politicize the Supreme Court, I think the lines between the separation of powers will be seriously blurred. And that one of your speakers traced the nuclear option back to 2013 when the Democrats changed the rules for federal judges. But I would like to point out that that was after there had been 200 filibusters preventing any of the nominations from the Obama into the federal positions. So the question of the Supreme Court being more and more politicized, as it was with that failure to even give Merrick Garland a hearing, is a serious problem, a constitutional problem for us.
I think John's concerns are well-founded. I appreciate him mentioning that the context of surrounding the previous changes to filibuster rules. I think that the only addition I would add is that the politicization of court appointments would not be created by the nuclear option being triggered at this point. I think that as the Merrick Garland example shows us, the fight over Supreme Court positions is already very political. It's not ideal, but maybe in a way we would be better served to admit that that was the case and avoid more of these nomination hearings where justices pretend to have no sense of no ability to discuss the matter of precedent in front of the Senate.
John, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had the shenanigans in Washington have me rolling on the floor, and if it wasn't sad, I'd be rolling even more on the floor with laughter. My question is, with a 50-50 split more or less in the country, instead of, say, 60-40 or 80-20, doesn't the 50-50 split east and west, north and south, Republican, Democrat, doesn't that mean there should be something forcing people to talk? And I don't see any of that. Should there be more discussion about that?
So you think there should be more compromise and less gridlock. Steve Engel.
Well, it's interesting that that's raised because I would suggest that the filibuster is one of the very tools that forces that kind of conversation. The logic of the filibuster is to try to meet a threshold of some level of supermajority, which would require some crossing over. So the fact that we are discussing the very real possibility of doing away with that might suggest that while it might make it easier for legislation or appointments to go through, it tips the balance of the country away from a kind of consensus-driven democratic republic to a more sort of majoritarian-driven democracy. Now, we may already be there, but I think it's interesting that we're taking away the tools that would try to compel the consensus away.
Jamie, did you have something to add? Did I hear your voice there?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. And I think it's funny, we talk about this from time to time in some of my classes, and I'm sure the other folks on the line with me do as well, but this kind of paradox that you hear people all the time say, well, you know, Washington is broken, people don't compromise, it doesn't work. And yet at the same time, if they send someone to Washington and that person votes on something a different way than they had pledged as part of a compromise, then they're a bunch of lying, crooked politicians that don't fulfill their campaign promises, right? It's like we always want bipartisan compromise on the things as long as the compromise is exactly the position that we want as voters. And, I mean, but we hold politicians to that. We say, why don't people ever compromise and come to a middle ground? And how dare you not vote exactly as you said you were going to vote before you went to D.C.? Those, if you're going to have one, I mean, it's going to be hard to do both at the same time at some point in time.
Ellery, thanks for your question. We'll go to Wilton and Susan. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi there. My question is for the group. You know, I'm hearing a lot that the doing away with the filibuster, as far as the Republicans concerned, is kind of a done deal. But my question to the group is, I'm wondering if there's any chance that the Republicans might consider keeping the filibuster, because once they do away with it, it's going to cut both ways in other nominations, that when there is a Democratic...
Oh, you know, Susan, you're fading, but you're fading, but something that's really related to what you're talking about. I was reading a New York Times article this morning. This is quoting from the article, without the current filibuster rule on legislation, Democrats, should they dominate Washington again one day, could seek a large increase in the minimum wage, increase Social Security benefits, paid family leave, or Medicare for all, and they would only need a simple majority to do it. Similarly, Republicans could pass large permanent tax cuts, oil drilling in the Arctic, or a national concealed carry gun law. So, Susan, I think this is what you're talking about. Is there a chance that before Mitch McConnell does this, he'll change his mind, Ron?
I mean, in the abstract, that argument makes really good sense. But in this particular instance, what we'd have to imagine is Democrats launching a filibuster against Judge Gorsuch and Mitch McConnell saying, for the sake of long-term strategy in the Senate, we're going to allow the Gorsuch nomination to be stalled in order to maintain the filibuster. And I just don't see that happening.
Stephen or Jamie, thoughts from you?
Yeah, I would tend to agree that in the contemporary circumstance, I don't necessarily see that happening. But that raises another question for me, which is, we've been here before, and one of the things that occurred a few years ago was the infamous Gang of 14 that salvaged the filibuster. And so I'm wondering, what is different now that we seem to be on this precipice of losing a rule that has been a sort of cornerstone of what it means to be in the Senate?
Jamie?
I mean, I think that, you know, the history of this has always been that once you start rolling it back, you don't go in the opposite direction. You know, so once it does kind of, and this is just for court ruling, I mean, this is just for Supreme Court nominations. It's not for legislation, potentially, though it could set the precedent for that. But that it's going to be hard for the party in power to want to change it. And then when the other party then gets in power to also want to change it, I'll say that, you know, part of this is also the Republicans are looking pretty good for the Senate coming up in 2 years. I mean, even with Trump's low approval rating and with even some backlash against some Republican policies, the Democrats are facing a real uphill challenge in 18 in terms of taking back the Senate if you just look at which seats are up for grabs. So the prospects of the Democrats actually taking back the Senate, that's probably something that's about 4 years out at the best. In 2 years, it's going to be pretty hard. And next year, I guess, would be the right word for it.
Susan, thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to Paul calling from Portland. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. Paul, are you there? Looks like we lost Paul. So I'll ask you all what I wanted to ask you earlier. Jamie McCown, it seems like old news now, but the idea that the health care reform plan, the idea to repeal and replace Obamacare failing in Congress, now we have talk about some of the Republicans coming back with another plan that could be voted on in May. So maybe a two-part question. What are the chances that something will be voted upon in May? And what are sort of the long-term implications of the failure of the Republicans' health care bill that was voted on a few weeks ago?
The prospects for what actually could come back again, it really depends. I mean, I've heard a couple of different things. One of them may be that there are a couple of very specific pieces that they may try to push forward, allowing states, for instance, to be able to waive out of the requirements about minimum requirements for policies, or also somehow, instead of necessarily removing the pre-existing condition law, one of the ideas would be that, well, we could have states waive out of the mechanism by which that law is kind of enforced, or at the very least the part that says we don't charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition. And maybe what they're looking to do is to try to be able to get some kind of piecemeal pieces done and then be able to declare victory for that. The other idea would be is that they take the break that's coming up, the Easter break, and, you know, the Trump people come back to some of the key Republicans that held out and see what they could do to make it happen. But there's an inherent balancing act here. You know, for all of the talk about the Freedom Caucus on the right and that those folks who didn't think the bill went far enough, every time you move in that direction, there are moderate Republicans in the House who are very concerned about their ability to win re-election in 2 years if they vote for something that goes too far in that direction. So I'm dubious as to how they're going to be able to balance those. I mean, if you tilt in one way, I'm not certain that you're not just going to lose votes on the other side of the Republican Party right now.
All right. Apparently, we do have Paul in Portland now. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me now?
I can. Great.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I know you already put this question out once to the panelists in regard to Russian hacking. The response I heard was in direct relation to a response to the Russian government. And what I'd like them to talk about is the response within our own democracy. If we've found that this administration has somehow colluded with Russian hacking and compromised the voting process, how does that unfold with prosecutable offenses and investigations? What does that look like, and how is that likely to unfold?
Steve, I'll give that to you.
Well, I do think that one of the responses beyond the kind of the whether there's a criminal accusation that would lead to, you know, the need for impeachment charges, I think we would be a few steps away from that. But I do think in terms of like the health of the democracy, what it would do would at least undermine the legitimacy of the Trump presidency. And insofar as he's already dealing with a presidency where he lost the popular vote, he's already dealing with a presidency. I mean, one of the things that became clear with the repeal and replace failure was that Trump didn't necessarily have a lot of leverage going into that that policy discussion, because he won less votes in Republican House districts than Republican House members. And so he doesn't come in a particularly strong position. And so I think it would just at least delegitimize the presidency further and would certainly tank the public opinion polls, which have already been trending in the wrong direction.
Paul, thanks for your question. We'll go up to Spruce Head and James. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering, in this day and age of turning politics on its head, would it be appropriate to change the Supreme Court so that instead of having a lifetime appointment, it was a 20-year appointment or a 15-year appointment or something? I really don't understand the lifetime appointments. People get old, they don't make good decisions. Who knows, you know? So what would it take to do that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Jamie, I'll have you take James's question.
Well, obviously, it would take constitutional changes to be able to make that happen. I think that, there's always debates about how court appointments should be done. You have certain states where, for instance, you have certain court appointments that are elected versus being appointed, and that has its own set of drawbacks as well if you want to talk about politicization of courts. I'm not a court scholar and not a scholar of the history of the court, but I would tell you that it's not the first time that people have raised that issue. And probably since, the founding of the Constitution, that debate about lifetime tenure has been around. I'm not certain, though, let's just be honest, that it's the same right now as the politicization question, which is a little bit more about what's actually going on in terms of how these folks are appointed, not as much how long they serve for.
All right. Well, on that note, we do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions.
You make Maine calling possible, as does Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco.
Some schools say they're seeing higher incidences of hate speech and racially motivated attacks, and many are struggling with how to handle it.
You know, this one was one that they don't teach you in administration 101 classes. There's no playbook for this one now.
How schools and students are responding to hate, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And coming up in 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, former director of the NSA and CIA, General Michael Hayden, assesses the successes and failures of U.S. intelligence gathering efforts and shares his insight on the challenges that lie ahead here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a national political update and some analysis. In the studio with me, Ron Schmidt, a professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Jamie McCown, a political science professor at the College of the Atlantic. And joining us from Bates College, Stephen Engel, chair of the politics department at Bates. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Jamie, who's calling from Unity. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hi. One of your previous callers mentioned what would happen if the filibuster was voted down, and that would give the party in power the chance to do just about anything they wanted to. And that's a perfect reason for having three parties and supporting a third party, because the chances of one party having all the power would be pretty much limited, and we'd have to go back to politics instead of whoever's the biggest and strongest and loudest gets what they want.
Jamie is not the only person who would like to see at least one more strong political party in this country.
No, I mean, that is true. There's a lot of desire for that. There's a couple of problems. One is that political parties are enormous organizations that are incredibly diverse. And it's not just a question of having candidates to run for president. Political parties, to be effective at supporting legislation, have grassroots. They have an infrastructure which is hard to build and to maintain. I mean, the Democrats are having trouble with their backbench in a number of states right now. But also, in addition to that, we have certain narratives of our political parties that are fairly broad, but there is a logic behind our parties. You know, the parties are big, big coalitions of smaller coalitions of interest groups. And although those groups fight amongst themselves a lot, as we saw a couple of weeks ago, there are still some shared assumptions the parties have that cover a lot of issues that attract voters. So a third party, to be effective, couldn't just be an alternative to the other two. It would need some kind of central relationships around policy to build itself up.
Jamie, thanks for your call. We'll move to Eastport and Virginia. Hi, Virginia. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I just have a couple of comments. You have a guest there. I don't remember his name, but he was saying how in 2 years the Senate will still have a Republican majority. I don't think so, because I didn't vote for Trump, but he made promises that he didn't keep. I mean, I felt like he duped the Rust Belt as far as the health care. I mean, I don't hear that too much in the media about how the it was basically a tax bill for anybody who made over $250,000 a year. So it was basically Robin Hood in reverse. And I don't hear too much of that. And my second comment is, I forgot.
That's okay, Virginia. That's funny. Jamie, was it you who said it was unlikely that the Senate would flip? Explain that calculation, because I think a lot of people feel this way, that in 2 years, forget the Senate. The whole Congress is going to flip.
Let's be honest. It's a mathematical equation. There are 34 Senate seats that are going to be open in 2018, okay? 34. Of that, 25 of them are ones that are held currently by Democrats. Only 9 are ones that are currently held by Republicans. Now, for the Democrats to take control of the Senate, they're going to have to hold all 25 of their seats and pick up 3 of the 9 Republican seats that are up for grabs. Now, that's going to be a tough road because in some of those Democrats, we're talking about Democrats that were elected in predominantly Republican states. And I'm not just talking about the ones that kind of Trump tilted, like Ohio, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, all of which have Democrats that are up. I'm talking about Democrats who have to be reelected in Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, and Indiana, for instance. A little bit more challenging there. I think that there's a good chance that they will hold most of those 25, but then where do you pick up the other 3? Don't get me wrong. I think there's probably going to be – I think the Democrats are going to make some headway in the House. I definitely think we're going to see that. There's a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy over there on the Democratic side. So I do expect that there's going to be a move that way. I just mean that in terms of taking back control of the Senate, it is a really bad year the way the calendar and the numbers are falling for the Democrats in the Senate in 18.
All right, Virginia, thanks for your call. Good question. Going to go to Felix, who's calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead.
Hi. Question. How is redistricting, do you think, is going to play out into the near future with the political situation we have right now?
Great question, Steve. Tell us how redistricting in the past decade has changed the House and Senate, or just the House, I suppose, and how it might the next time, in the next go-round.
Well, I think what the caller is referring to is the possibility of gerrymandering, and so we have some safe seats that could lead and make it quite difficult for party turnover in the House. So while Jamie's earlier comment, and I would agree, would suggest that there's some possibility in 2018 for some narrowing of the Republican majority, the districting and the way the districts have been drawn suggests the possibility of some safe seats for the incumbents.
All right, Felix, thanks for your question. We'll go to Ron calling from Lebanon. Hi, Ron, go ahead.
Hello. My question is a follow-up to a question just a while ago about the illegitimacy of the president's election. Now, if it were determined that it was a legitimate, wouldn't both people on the ticket be asked to leave, president and vice president, because they ran together on the same ticket? So one would be the same as the other as far as being illegitimate. And that would move constitutionally the presidency to the Speaker of the House.
Who would determine that it was illegitimate?
Well, the question that one of the callers had before and the commentary was that through this investigation that there was collusion and that Russians had influenced the election to the point where it had been determined that it was illegitimate. And wouldn't the president and vice president be removed from office?
And the question is, who would would that be, a Supreme Court? Who would?
I mean, but earlier we were talking less about a question of finding of a criminal conspiracy, say, which would involve impeachment charges, I'm sure, in a trial. We were thinking more in terms of, I think, the perceived legitimacy of the Trump administration, that even if no criminal activity were alleged or uncovered, but we did by members of the Trump administration, but there was a finding that Russia had interfered extensively in our election, that would undermine the Trump administration's claims to have any kind of a mandate, which is already pretty weak.
I think what Ron's asking, though, is with the whole election, is there a chance the whole election would be deemed illegitimate and that we'd need a do-over of some sort? Is that what you're asking, Ron?
You can't have one without the other, right? You elected both of them on the same ticket at the same time. So, therefore, in my way of thinking, it should be consistent that the vice president is in the mix, too.
So, Jamie, Stephen, one of you was going to jump in. Which was it?
I was just going to follow up to suggest that if there were findings of some alleged criminal activity such that they fit the impeachment, the constitutional definition of high crimes and misdemeanors, you would need to have an impeachment finding and then a trial held by the Senate. But my understanding would be that those would actually, while you could, I guess, conceptualize that the president and vice president might both be involved, it would require two separate trials. And then the caller is, in fact, right. If there was a impeachment of both the president and of the vice president, but they would occur separately and then separate trials held by the Senate and they were both convicted, then you would default to the third in line to the presidency, who is the Speaker of the House.
Ron, thanks. Go ahead.
I would just add that we're very far away from any kind of determination like that.
Okay, we'll move on to Kenny Bunk and Mary. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm curious about how it works to appoint federal judges. Does the president get to appoint a whole new group of federal judges or other judges on the Supreme Court?
Well, when there are openings in the court, the president nominates candidates, and then they have to be confirmed for their positions. The current, how should I put it, maybe compromise regarding the filibuster was actually set in regard to judges like those rather than Supreme Court justices.
Mary, thanks for your question. I want to wrap up with a discussion of what might come next. We're hearing talk about tax reform. Stephen, what do you expect to see, and what is the lesson of the health care reform efforts teach us about what might happen with tax reform efforts?
Well, I do think that there's bipartisan appetite for some corporate tax reform, but I find one of the challenges of the tax reform bill and why I think initially it was to come second was that some of the initial ideas that would enable tax reform were relying on revenue savings that would come from repeal and replace. And so because repeal and replace has not happened, it's not quite clear how they will come up with tax reforms that are revenue neutral.
And Jamie, do you expect to see some of the same factions that, you know, the more conservative Tea Party Republicans will feel differently about tax reform than some of the more centrist Republicans, and the same thing in the Democratic Party?
Some. I think it's going to depend exactly what we're looking at, whether or not we're looking at individual rates, corporate rates. And I completely agree with the earlier comment that, you know, these were supposed to be sequenced with health care coming first. I think we also the kind of factions that you're talking about, I think, will definitely be exposed by the end of this month, perhaps, when we start talking about passing a comprehensive budget bill and things like the wall and how much that's going to cost, if it's a wall or a fence or whatever. All of those are going to be, you know, and infrastructure plans cost a lot of money. You've got Tea Party folks who don't want to spend that. These fissures in the party are going to come out.
And Ron, what are you going to be watching for in the next couple months? are you just going to be holding onto your seat?
You know, a few weeks ago I had sort of a viewing list, but at this point I'm just seeing what comes.
Okay. And I'm curious, since all three of you are professors, if I can ask each of you, and Steve, I'll start with you. How do you make sense of all this to your students, to 18, 19, 20-year-olds? What is it like for them to be, you know, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton was likely Bernie Sanders, the first person they voted for president. This is right. All new for them.
Yeah, it is definitely new. It was interesting being with them on election night and watching them respond in real time. I think at Bates, one of the things we've tried to do is, as a professor of constitutional law, there have been days with regards to, say, for example, the executive order on immigration, where I just, you know, stopped my syllabus for the day and we had a discussion about that and told them that if they may not understand it by the end of the course, they would have the tools. Similarly, one of the things we've done is we've had a number of panels on the Affordable Care Act to understand what was coming next. And also that really came from the students and the students trying to come up with a policy issue on which there could be some conversation and civil disagreement and debate. And so the students are really modeling for us the importance of having open public discussion in an era of increasing partisan polarization.
And Jamie, many of your students up at College of Atlantic are majoring in things that are related to the environment and sustainability, aren't they?
Yeah, that's a heavy emphasis for a number of our students. And I think for them, you know, you were asking how do I make sense of this for our students. I sometimes wonder that the bigger challenge for me is how I make sense of this for some of my fellow faculty who are asking me what's exactly going on. It's made for some, they've lived through more of it. I think that I want to agree that it's actually I've seen more students wanting to be engaged in some of the more traditional channels of electoral politics, not just being political, meaning take to the streets, or politics means, you know, what you eat or what you wear, but also, you know, asking questions about things like filibuster or cloture or, you know, how they can actually run for office and going to city and town council meetings. I think that's a really positive sign. And also being interested in history. I mean, so that we can kind of give students a historical context for, you know, sometimes the things we think are specific about now have actually been before, and maybe some things we assumed have always been that way are actually unique to now. That helps a lot. And so I think that I'm actually positive on the fact that more students are wanting to be interested in being traditionally political in the electoral type of way.
And Ron, I have a feeling your students are very engaged right now.
They are. In the classroom, I've tried to share with students the degree to which political science is trying to figure out what's going on. But outside of the classroom, my students have actually been working very hard at trying to find ways to communicate across the political spectrum and to do something about the things they're concerned about. So I've mainly just tried to make myself a resource.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for being here. Great team. Stephen Engel, the chair of the politics department at Bates College. Jamie McCown, a political science professor at the College of the Atlantic. And Ron Schmidt, a professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today, and Sam Dearen answered the phones. We had additional help from Rich Tozier in Bangor. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. You can always find it at mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about shoemaking in Maine. We'll learn about Maine's long history of shoemaking and current challenges and opportunities for shoe manufacturing in the state. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.